So the particular questions we're confronted with right now are these. Should a Christian retirement or a long-term care home allow MAID on its site? Should a Christian physician give an effective referral for MAID? And if another mechanism were provided, namely a referral service that's independent of the physicians and which individual persons can access directly, would providing that phone number to call a referral agency be morally different from what's called an effective referral? Now, the questions are complex, but it seems to me, trying to think biblically as a Christian, there are two principles, biblical principles, that come to mind. The first is that some forms of association with evildoers are themselves sinful. If I have dinner with an evil person, I'm not committing sin. But in the Bible, sometimes we have illustrations. The one I use is from the little epistle of 2 John near the end of the New Testament, in which John writes to those who are wrestling with false teachers who are circulating, claiming to teach what is true, and in fact they are denying essential truth about Jesus Christ. And John says there, if you welcome that false teacher into your home, if you provide Christian hospitality, extend Christian fellowship to one who denies essential Christian truth, you share in that person's sins. We aren't, now, in the case of MAID, if a Christian long-term care home welcomes those who facilitate MAID in their home, I would argue they are welcoming those who both teach what is false about human life and apply that in destructive ways. And then a second principle is this, that acting in ways that lead other persons to sin is itself sinful. In the paper that I've given you, I point to two places in Paul's epistles where he's dealing with issues of the extent of Christian liberty, what is it we're free to do, and he makes the point that if I use my liberty, even if I'm using my liberty to do something that I am in fact morally free to do, But I do it in a way that offends the conscience of another and causes another to violate their conscience, thus causes another to sin, I am failing to act in love, and I am sinning. That has all kinds of relevance, I think, for the physician whose conscience will not allow him or her to facilitate suicide, who believes that would be a sinful act. And to facilitate sin, even Paul says, even if I lead another person into sin without knowingly and willfully doing that, I still am not acting in love. In this case of an effective referral, we would be doing it very much willingly. Now, in Alberta, at least, I'm not sure about other provinces, in Alberta, they have sought to deal with the problem of conscience by providing a referral agency that individuals can call directly and be referred to a physician or nurse practitioner who will facilitate MAID. Now, I saw one newspaper article a couple of weeks ago that seemed to say that was happening in Ontario, but it's actually not. When I read the article, I said to my wife, wow, that looks like a good step forward, but I believe somehow that was misleading. It might have come up for discussion, but it has not been put into place. Would it be different if we had the Alberta model and a physician could say, this is a phone number that you can call if you really want to do that? I think the physicians I'm thinking of here probably will come to different conclusions on that. I'm suggesting that it seems to me there may in fact be a morally significant difference, and that physician could say something like this: I can't with a clear conscience suggest that you do this, that you see another physician who will agree to enable your suicide. But the choice that you want to make is in fact legal. I recognize that, and I respect your right to make a decision that I can't support. My counsel is that you not make that choice, but if you insist, you can use this contact information to initiate the process. As I say, I imagine the physicians I'm thinking of here will sometimes feel comfortable doing that and sometimes not. Now, from what I've read, it appears that Ontario will allow institutions to refuse to allow MAID on site if they make this clear to residents and potential residents. I can't say I'm confident that this will continue to be the case, but it looks to be possible for now. Back in January, when I was at that meeting in Toronto, the lawyer representing this Ontario Association of Homes for Seniors indicated that the legislation in Ontario about long-term care homes is very clearly indicates that that long-term care facility is the home. It is the residence of each of those patients. And that statement may be used to force long-term care homes, even those that are faith-based, to allow MAID on site. The jury is still out, I think, on that one. We will see where that goes. The current statement of the Ontario College requires that physicians who have conscientious objections must make an effective referral. So any physician who refuses to do that for conscience reasons risks losing their license to practice medicine in the province. Now, I think then we need to all help make the case to allow for that kind of conscientious objection. And that is, in fact, in process right now. There is litigation. I know that at least one group of five physicians has filed suit against the Ontario College, and we will see where that goes. I asked the question here near the end, will some forms of civil disobedience be required in our context? Well, it looks premature at this point because we're still coming to terms with the demands of the new legislation and the regulations to put it in practice. For now, I think we have to focus on arguments to be made in defense of freedom of religion and conscience, and we have to press that case. I can imagine the time may come when Christian physicians, nurse practitioners, other healthcare professionals, Christian institutions may be forced to make some very hard choices, might be forced into some forms of civil disobedience, but that's not the point we're at right now. So my conclusions in the end are these. First of all, the choice to actively terminate one's life or to facilitate such a choice is to be rejected. It's a violation of God's command to protect all innocent human life. Command that's grounded in the inherent sanctity of life made in God's image. Secondly, Christian institutions and healthcare providers will then appropriately be driven by their biblically informed conscience to refuse to engage in or facilitate MAID. And finally, in a pluralistic society supposedly committed to diversity and inclusivity, legal and regulatory provisions should be made to allow for conscientious objectors to be disengaged from the practice of MAID, given the diversity of opinion and the significance of the issue. I do find it highly ironic that in a country in which the public rhetoric is very much about being inclusive and diverse, there is sometimes a tyranny that comes down from above that says, if you're stuck in the past, in traditional views about things like this, you aren't allowed to follow your conscience down that road. We're going to force you to not only recognize that MAID is legal, we're going to force you to affirm it. We're not there yet, and I trust that we can find ways to to push back on that. Now, Julie, coming up, and I want you to share some of your wisdom with us.
Thanks, Dan. It's great. A lot of information to take in. Now, Graham, my husband, who's the pastor here, has given me a specific job. He wanted me to talk a little bit about what is actually happening here in Brantford right now, and then talk about palliative care as an alternative. Today was my day to do hospice and palliative care visits. So I spent the day with people that are actively dying and who are getting symptom relief and going through this journey. And I spent the day at the hospice visiting my people there. So I feel very fired up right now to talk about this. So I've written some notes as well so I don't get carried away and so I don't talk too fast. And then I'm sure there's going to be some questions afterwards, so we'll facilitate that as well. So as Stan said, it was in July 2016 that people were beginning to be able to access MAID here in Ontario. And I'm not sure how many people know this, but since that time there have been 744 people up until December 2016 that chose to end their life with this physician-assisted dying. 180 of those in Ontario. So that was just from July last year to December. People don't realize, even healthcare physicians I've talked to at the BGH, that this is happening here in Brantford. There have been a few cases already at the BGH, and there have been cases in people's homes. As Stan said, there's an outreach line for referrals, so if I am approached by a patient, I am obligated at this point to call this number and arrange for them to meet up with a team that can facilitate the evaluation process. And as Stan mentioned, right now it is my duty as a physician to call this number, and this is something that many people in my field, myself included, are struggling with. So as a Christian physician, I choose to support and promote and work in the field of palliative care. This allows me to share Christ's love with my patients and to recognize God's sovereignty over life. Romans 11:33 to 36 says, "Oh, the depth of the riches and wisdom of God. How unsearchable are his judgments and how unscrutable his ways. For who has known the mind of the Lord, or who has been his counselor?" I want to spend a few minutes educating everyone about what exactly palliative care is and what it is not. Palliative care is defined as the broad approach to providing comfort and dignity for patients and families who are living with or at risk of developing a life-threatening illness. Palliative care focuses on the quality of life of people who have a progressive, life-altering illness. It includes pain and symptom management, psychosocial, emotional, and spiritual support, and comfortable living conditions with appropriate levels of care. Studies have shown that patients who receive palliative support have a higher quality of life, less visits to the emergency room, and reduced disease symptoms. Palliative care is not hastening death. It is not only for people with cancer, and it does not mean that that own patient's physician has given up on that person. It means that the hope becomes less about a cure for the disease and more about living life as fully as possible. So if palliative care is not just for cancer patients and it's for anyone facing end of life, who exactly is it for? As physicians, we often ask ourselves, would we be surprised if this patient died in the next 12 months? If the answer is no, then that person should be receiving palliative care of some form. It sounds simple. Unfortunately, it's underfunded, underavailable, and perhaps misunderstood. A recent study found that of the people who died in Ontario in 2014 and 2015, only 57% of those people received palliative care. And of those, only 12% had received it during their final 2 months of life. As those of you who go to our church know, Graham likes to leave people with implications, so I have three for you. One, be open to dialogue with your own family physician as you go through life, and be open to dialogue about your healthcare goals. Two, be familiar with Brantford's palliative outreach team. I'm happy to answer any questions you have. There's ways to volunteer. There's all kinds of information if you have friends or family that are in this last 12 months of life, and I would love to share that to you. And perhaps the greatest implication, and this goes along with some of Stan's encouragement, although we need to be fighting to put some guidelines specifically with MAID, perhaps even our bigger fight should be to put more resources towards palliative care so this is something that everyone is able to access. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Julie, for that. One of the board members at Nisbet Lodge in Toronto, the group that I met with at the end of January, is a woman who oversees nursing, actually, at a Toronto hospital and is very deeply involved in palliative care. And she came alive as well during our discussion. And I don't know how much you know about it. I know there's a special, I think, committee of MPs, perhaps, mm-hmm. who are trying to stimulate a much stronger commitment mm-hmm. to palliative care right. in Canada as a whole. Mm-hmm. So there, in many ways, this cry for help of suffering people is a serious call for us to think much harder, commit ourselves much more thoroughly to providing tangible ways to care for people in the dying process. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, we have 15 minutes or so that we want to use to allow for questions from you, and that one of us or both of us can respond to them, or we may end up dialoguing with one another about it. So, who's first? By the way, I have to say, seeing this many people here on a Thursday night in spring, it is spring, right? Yeah. It's really encouraging to see you coming to hear about, to think about, to talk about a very serious topic. Okay, now I gave you time to formulate a question or a relevant comment. Yes?
Yes, you say that we have palliative care, which we do, but do we have enough facilities for palliative care? That's the thing, isn't it?
Right, so I agree, Diana. So Stan was saying that there's a group of people together, the Ontario Palliative Care Network, I think it is, that is trying to lobby for more, because I agree, not everyone has access to it. We're lucky to live in Brantford. I think that in all of Ontario, we probably have the best palliative care program, but it is definitely at a loss, especially in more rural areas.
In these studies, was insurance companies involved in any way?
Huh. In the studies, like in the ad hoc committee that was created to bring recommendations to Parliament? That's a good question. I really don't know. Do you?
I have no information about that. But that's an interesting question as far as why did that person pass away and what does that mean as far as life insurance and things from there?
Yes. I have a thick folder over there of material. And I think somewhere in there is some information I received from other presenters back in January at that meeting I was at, saying something about the legislation as it relates to insurance policies and suicide. And I
Rosalyn,
I'm not sure. Maybe someone knows.
I do know that in the United States right now, they're not paying insurance policies out. Mm. That has not been determined yet in Canada, but they're going to the courts right now in the United States if they will not pay life insurance policy.
Yeah.
Assisted dying.
Yeah, we will see what kind of legislation might come down in Canada. I have a feeling legislation may come which will prevent insurance companies from refusing to pay, but time will tell on that. There's a lot. I mean, there is the legislation in place since June of last year, but there are still a lot of details that are in flux with regard to how that's worked out in practice. Yes, the back.
So if you know if currently a physician or a nurse practitioner refused to provide a timely referral for someone would they be charged with allegations of professional misconduct, or would it be handled more at this point in, caution disciplinary?
Oh, I don't. There'd be some sort of disciplinary action, but I'm not sure at this point what exactly it would be.
Because it just says that, the college requires that they give that.
Right.
Is that
that is, we must refer. And it must be timely, which is quite interesting. You know, you only have so many days to put that referral through, but I can have a palliative patient that's quite symptomatic. A family physician could refer a palliative patient, but there's no, you must see this patient within 10 days. But there are very strict guidelines for seeing that person that wants made.
Yeah. Sure. Yes, the back over here.
Yeah. Maybe Julie can help us on this. Just palliative care may involve giving doses of pain medication, all that, as Stan talked about with your experience. Can you just fill that out a little bit for us?
So I really don't believe that the medications we're giving are hastening someone's death. It is true that we use medications that may have some sleepiness associated with them, but there's nothing that we would give that would specifically speed up their dying process. That's my firm belief. Does that answer your question enough? Or are you looking for...
That probably will help me correct my paper at that point. Well, that's fine. What about opium? What about opioids?
So opioids in appropriate doses should not end someone's life. If you give someone too much morphine, their breathing will slow down. There are signs that someone's been given too much narcotic, and that is not something we would choose to do. We have people that are administering medications that know what side effects look like, and they just give enough to have that person comfortable.
That's good. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. I'm learning too. Here. Yes.
So what is the procedure when the person comes to your house? Like, is it quick or is it like, how do they do it?
Are you asking what the process of when someone asks for physician assisted suicide, what it looks like? So they must have a referral on a fairly timely basis, and then they are seen by two people, which hopefully they're seen quickly, but we have had a case recently that it took a week or so for the people to deliberate that whether or not they thought this person was actively dying. There is a 10-day period, which they call the 10-day cooling off period, that that person has to take back their decision and to try and give that person time. However, the person must be competent on the day that they are going to end their life. So if there is fear that that person may not stay capable for those 10 days, then they can actually apply to have those 10 days shortened. So they could go from, yes, I would like this, to the next day having these two consults, to the next day potentially ending their life. And it's not a matter of the physician giving them medications that they're giving to themselves. They are getting IV medications that very quickly end their life. And they're being pushed by a physician. It's not the patient that's injecting themselves.
But the legislation does allow for a prescription to be given.
Yes,
it does allow for self-administered.
Yes, yeah. I haven't seen the
doses.
Cases that are happening in the hospital are being administered by a team.
Julie mentioned the statistics for last year in the first 6 months, basically, of the practice of May. There were about 180 or something like that in Ontario. The number of those who self-administered it was, I think, 3. I saw the statistics. I have a list somewhere, that massive pile over there, of the number of people who accessed MAID in different municipalities in Ontario. I should have checked Brantford before I came, but I didn't. I mean, a very large portion of those were in Toronto and other metropolitan areas. But because it generally is, it's not pills at this point, it's very hard for people to self-administer it at home. So normally it is given by IV, by the healthcare professionals.
Does that answer your question?
Is it quick?
So is it quick, their death? Their death would be very quick. Is the process of going through it, the longest it has to, it could be as short as 10 days.
No, but I mean when they actually put the IV in, it's quick. It's like, yeah.
When the doctor makes out a death certificate, what is the cause of death?
Oh. that's a good question, because I haven't had to do one. Fortunately, everyone else takes over. I think that it has to say that it is a physician assisted dying, and it, the coroner actually at this point still has to be called to all those deaths, even though it was a planned death. The coroner comes as part of it.
Is there an autopsy performed?
No.
Even though the family may require it?
If the family asks for one, I'm sure they can have one. Their cause of death will still be the medications that were given. They could get details, I suppose, of what their medical illness was leading up to that.
I believe there were some changes of it. When this legislation came into effect, I think some other laws had to be changed.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the laws that used to call what those doctors do a crime. But I think some of the legislation about the reporting of
mm-hmm.
the death was altered as
and
well.
And it's still in the works as far as does the coroner come, does he not, and that kind of thing. Yeah. Carrie?
Julie, I was just going to mention that when I was listening to the talk from doctors from Mount Sinai, I
yeah.
think they mentioned that when there's an issue, say with a family whose religion doesn't permit or doesn't condone this, they write something other than name on the
Oh, interesting.
Or they write me so that the coroner can see that,
right.
And then the coroner is given that information so that the final document does not say made on it.
Oh, okay.
To prevent families from not having their family buried on sacred grounds that don't condone it.
Right.
They gave that example.
Oh, interesting. Thanks, Carrie. Carrie, you can ask lots of questions too. She's one of our nurses at the hospice. She's a wealth of information.
We're surrounded by medical people here. I'm very partial to medical people. My wife is an RN, and my daughter is an anesthesia assistant and works in the operating room. And so family gatherings at our house, there's really no limit on what we might talk about. Anybody else?
Josh?
You're probably referring to my comment, right? So I'll take a stab first.
Perfect.
Ethicists, when talking about this, will often make a distinction between passive euthanasia and letting die. The line is not always bright and clear, but the fundamental difference lies in the intent. And so when we talk about letting someone die, we tend to mean not utilizing life-sustaining technologies that are available that seem extraordinary and excessive in a variety of ways. And so it isn't that we are intending the death of the person, but we recognize that death is coming very soon. So with regard to an individual may choose to let themselves die by, let's say, refusing chemotherapy. A person may have found they have cancer and it's almost certain they have very short time to live. Chemotherapy that they could take might extend their life a little bit, but it would adversely affect the quality of their life in the dying process. And so instead of doing some kind of really strong chemotherapy that might prolong their life from 2 months to 5 months, they simply refuse the chemotherapy and let themselves die. Similar decisions could be made about other persons by people who have the authority to make the decisions. Does that make any sense?
Sure. Does that answer your question, Josh? Not quite.
I admit, it is not always a perfectly clear line. It is a bit fuzzy sometimes. But I think a morally significant difference is the intent.
Mm-hmm.
Am I withdrawing this because I want to hasten the death? Or am I withdrawing this technology because in reality it's not providing enough good to justify the cost and the pain involved? In fact, in this whole discussion, it seems to me We're trying to think of it, from a biblically oriented Christian perspective. We need to recognize that there are challenging and difficult cases. I understand that there are cases in which people say, I really would rather just bring this to an end right now. I understand that. Human suffering is real, and we shouldn't deny that. So when dealing with all this, I'm not denying that there are cases that are really difficult. But exceptional cases don't establish the rule.
And I wanted to interject one thing there. Nowhere in the main legislation, as far as I know, or the protocols that hospitals are following, does it say that someone requesting MAID must have a palliative care consult first, must be made comfortable before they make that decision. So someone could make this decision before they even, you know, knew that there was an opportunity for comfort while they were along this journey.
Yeah. Okay, we've probably got time for one more, and then we're going to need to bring it to an end. Yes.
That's a big question. I'm not sure I can answer all of it. We will chat more, all the Belfors back there. So the first part of it was, how do we address the need? And really, it's a financial thing, I think, at this point, right? Many of you know that we opened our hospice in Brantford 2 or 3 years ago, but it just took until the last 8 months or so to get funding for our last 5 beds, right? So there is a need. It's funding that is the issue. As far as palliative care and experiences of families coming to know God, I don't know that I have any specific cases where people came to know God more through their journey, but certainly they may come in very afraid, and these are people we want to get to know early in their journey. We want to know people that have been told, you know, there's nothing else we can do for your heart condition, or you have a cancer that we can't cure. We want to meet those people well ahead of their symptoms, well ahead of the time that they're really struggling, so we can take that journey with them. And at first, it's just it may be a bit of an emotional journey, and we may not see them for a while, and a couple months may tick by, and now they do have symptoms. And so we're meeting them and relieving those symptoms. And then the next little hurdle may be more emotional. Family have come to visit. And so you journey that road with them. And we have amazing psychosocial support as well. So it's just, usually by the time they get to their final days, they are in a place that they're ready. And it's beautiful to see, especially those believers that are, you know, they're ready to go home to God. And that's going to be the next best thing. So really, end of life can be very beautiful in the palliative context.
That's a good note to end on, I think. Now, ordinarily, at this point, I would say, okay, Graham, back to you. But Graham's under the weather and hopefully dealing adequately with the kids at home. Now, we're supposed to tell you that there are some refreshments back here, which, as we conclude, you're invited to come back and enjoy. I don't avoid food, so I'm hanging around for a while before I go home to Kitchener, and we'd be happy to talk further. Let me lead us in prayer as we conclude. Lord God, you are the source of our life. You are the creator. We are the creature. We owe all that we are and have to you. And we pray that you will enable us to value life that you give us and others. And in our time and place, in all its complexities, with all its challenges, legal and medical and otherwise, make us wise by your Spirit to live in ways that will please you and in ways that indeed will love others as ourselves. So guide all of us here in decisions that we may face in the very near future, and enable us to be channels of your grace to others, especially to those who are, in fact, in the dying process. And so we yield ourselves to you and pray that you will make us wise and courageous as obedient followers of Christ, who loved us and gave himself for us. In his name we ask. Amen.